The encounter in the desert sure socked the sandals off of Moses. We wonder what amazed the old fellow, whether it was God speaking from a bush or whether it was God speaking at all. Moses had made a mistake. You remember the story. He adopted nobility, an Israelite reared in an Egyptian palace. His countrymen were slaves, but Moses was privileged, ate at the royal table, educated in the finest schools. But his most influential teacher had no degree. She was his mother, a Jewess who was hired to be his nanny. Moses, you could almost hear her whisper to her young son, "God has put you here on purpose. Someday you will set your people free." Never forget, Moses. Never forget. And Moses didn't. The flame of justice grew hotter until it blazed, and Moses saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew slave. Moses killed the Egyptian. And the next day Moses saw the Hebrew. You'd think the slave would say thanks, but he didn't. He reacted with anger. He said, "God," he said, "are you going to kill me as you kill that Egyptian?" From 10 men of the Bible, Max Lucado comments, Moses knew he was in trouble. So he fled Egypt and hid in the wilderness. Call it a career shift. He went from dining with heads of state to counting the heads of sheep. Hardly an upward move. And so it happened that a bright, promising Hebrew began herding sheep on the hills. He went from the Ivy League to the cotton patch, from the Oval Office to catching a taxi cab, from swinging a golf club to digging a ditch. Moses thought the move was permanent. There's no indication that he ever intended to go back to Egypt. In fact, there's almost every indication that he wanted to stay with his sheep. But standing barefoot before the bush, he confessed in Exodus 3:11, "I am not a great man. How can I go to the king and lead the Israelites out of Egypt?" I'm glad Moses asked the question. It's a good one. Why Moses? Or more specifically, why 80-year-old Moses? The 40-year-old version was far more appealing. The Moses we saw in Egypt was brash and confident, but the Moses we find four decades later is reluctant, weather-beaten. Had you and I looked at Moses back in Egypt, we'd say this man's ready for battle. He was educated in the finest system in the world. He was trained by the ablest soldiers. Instant access to the inner circle of the Pharaoh. Moses spoke their language. He knew their habits. He was the perfect man for the job. Moses at 40, we like. But Moses at 80? No way. He's too old, too tired. Smells like a shepherd. Speaks like a foreigner. What impact could he possibly have on Pharaoh? He's the wrong man for the job. And Moses would have agreed. Tried that once before, he would say, "Those people don't want to be helped. Just leave me here to tend my sheep, and they're easier to lead." Moses wouldn't have gone, and you wouldn't have sent him, neither would have I. But God did. Go figure. Would you choose a wanted murderer to lead a nation out of bondage? Would you call on a fugitive to carry the Ten Commandments? But God did. He called him of all places right out there in the sheep pasture, called his name through a burning bush, scared old Moses right out of his shoes. Why? What did God know that Moses knew now that he didn't know before? What did Moses learn in the desert that he didn't learn in Egypt? Well, the ways of the desert, for one thing. 40-year-old Moses was a city boy, octogenarian Moses knew the name of every snake. He knew where every watering hole was out in the desert. And if he's going to lead thousands of Hebrews through the wilderness, he needs to know Desert Life 101. Family dynamics for another. If he's going to be traveling with families for 40 years, it might help to understand how they work. He marries a woman of faith, the daughter of a Midianite priest, and he establishes his own family. But more than the ways of the desert and the people, Moses needed to learn something about himself. And apparently he has learned it. And God now says, Moses, you are ready. And to convince him, God speaks through a burning bush. He had to do something dramatic to get Moses' attention. School's out, God tells him. Now's the time to get to work. Poor Moses, he didn't even know he was enrolled, but he was. And guess what? So are you. The voice from the bush is the voice that whispers to you. It reminds you that God is not finished with you yet. Oh, you may think he is. You may think you've peaked. You may think he's got someone else to do the job. If so, think again. School was out for Moses. God had deemed him to be the right person to lead the Hebrew people out of slavery in Egypt, across the wilderness, and into the promised land. And Moses' unique strengths and characteristics, combined with his background and 80 years worth of life experiences, had made him custom fit for the task at hand. And unfortunately, Moses couldn't see it. So God would have to broaden his perspective and give him a glimpse of the big picture and how he fits into it. Warren Wiersbe writes, God can take an insignificant bush, ignite it, turn it into a miracle. And that's what he wanted to do with Moses. Some see the burning bush as a picture of Israel. They are God's light in the world, persecuted but not consumed. But the burning bush was also a picture of what God wanted to do with Moses. He was the meek, weak bush that God empowered with fire. And with God's help, Moses could accomplish anything. The size of the task anyone faces isn't nearly as significant as that person's reliance on God for help. In the New Testament, the Apostle Paul summarized a lesson that Moses would learn over the next 40 years. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Charles Stanley, from his life principles, Moses spent 40 years in the wilderness feeding sheep, but those years were not wasted. The Lord was in the process of preparing him for service. And when Moses was ready, when brokenness had reached its goal, God called to him from the midst of the burning bushes and gave him a specific set of instructions and life mission. Many of us go through difficult and even devastating experiences and then one day come face to face with the reality and calling of God in our lives. Is this the pattern that God seems to be implementing in your life? If so, stick with his plan, regardless of how extraordinary it may seem, for the promised land lies in that direction. Max Lucado, writing in They Walked With God, comments, poor Moses, he's still not convinced. Suppose they don't believe me or listen to my voice. Suppose they say you haven't appeared to me. What's that in your hand? Speaks the voice from the bush. This? It's just my walking stick. Throw it down. Moses, who has walked on this mountain for 40 years, is not comfortable with the command, God, you know a lot about a lot of things, but you don't know that out here, out in the wilderness, you just don't go around throwing down your staff. After all, you never know when. Moses, throw it down. So Moses throws it down. The rod becomes a snake, and Moses begins to turn away. Moses, and the old shepherd stops, pick up the snake. Moses peers over his shoulder, looks first at the snake and then the bush, and then he gives the most courageous answer he can muster. What? Pick up the snake by the tail. God's got to be smiling at this point. God, I don't mean to object. I mean, I said you know a lot of things, but out here in the desert, you don't pick up snakes too often, and you certainly don't pick them up by the tail. Moses. Yes, sir. And just as Moses' hand touches the squirmy scales of the snake, it hardens. And Moses lifts up the rod, the same rod he would lift up in Pharaoh's court, the same rod he would lift to divide the water and guide 2 million people through a desert. The rod that would remind Moses that if God can make a stick become a snake and turn it back from a snake into a stick again, then perhaps he could do something with stubborn hearts, stiff-necked people. Perhaps he could do something with the common. Our achievements, however noble they may be, are not important. Our credentials, as starry as they might be, are of no concern. God is the foundation of the house. And the key question is not how strong am I, but how strong is God? The focus is always on his strength, not ours. And that's what Moses did, or at least that's what God told Moses to do. And as we read further, we discover God spent no time convincing Moses that he was ready, but he spent more time convincing Moses and explaining to him what God could do. You and I probably do the opposite. We'd explain to Moses how he ideally is suited to return to Egypt. After all, he grew up in the king's court. He understands the culture. He's a former prince. And then we'd remind Moses how perfect he is for the wilderness travel. Who knows the desert better than a shepherd? We'd spend time reviewing with Moses all of his resume and all of his great strengths. And come on, Moses, you know you can do this. Try it. But God doesn't. He never even considers Moses' strength. No pep talk is given. No pat on the back is offered. Not one word is spoken to recruit Moses. But many words are spoken to him to reveal God. The strength of Moses is not the issue. The strength of God is. Satan and his horde must have howled with delight the day that Moses went running out of Egypt by the very people he wanted to deliver. They thought they had derailed God's plan, when actually they had played into God's hand, and God had used the defeat to humble his servant and the wilderness to train him. And now some 40 years later, Moses stood with his brother Aaron before Pharaoh. This was a seasoned Moses, and he'd learned to listen to God and survive in the desert. Let my people go, Moses said to Pharaoh. But the king of Egypt refused, so God gave him a front row seat in the arena of divine devotion. The entire ancient East soon knew what God could do. Aaron's staff became a snake. The Nile became blood. The air was so filled with gnats that people breathed them. The ground so layered with locusts that they crunched them. noonday blackness. Hail pounded crops, flesh landscaped with boils, funerals for the firstborn. So Pharaoh finally let the people go. But then he changed his mind. He chased the Israelites to the Red Sea, which God turned into a red carpet, and the Egyptian army drowned. You know, when when kids learn Bible stories in Sunday school or from their parents, they're inclined sometimes to share them with others. And they may tell it exactly as they heard it, or they may repeat it in some way that makes far more sense to them. You know, like Moses crossing the Red Sea or Judas asparagus. 9-year-old Joey was asked by his mother what he had learned today in Sunday school. "Well, Mom, our teacher told us how God sent Moses behind enemy lines on a rescue mission to lead the Israelite people out of Egypt. And when he got to the Red Sea, he had his army build a pontoon bridge all the way across, and all the people walked to safety. Then he radioed headquarters for reinforcements, and they sent bombers that blew up the bridges, and all the Israelites were saved." Now, Joey, is that really the way the Sunday school teacher taught you? "Well, no, Mom. But if I told it the way the teacher did, you'd never believe it." Well, Moses knew that God could part the Red Sea. And Moses knew that God could move mountains. And he knew this because the mountain that he was on was shaking. And when God spoke, Sinai shook. And Moses' knees followed suit. Moses certainly knew what God could do. And yet he knew what the people were also prone to do. And when Moses came down from Sinai, he found them dancing around a golden calf. He was carrying the handwriting of God on stone. And here the Israelites were worshiping a heartless farm animal. It was more than Moses could take. It was more than God could take. And the Lord had given the people a mayor seat perch right there in the Exodus extravaganza. He had earned their trust. The former slaves had witnessed a millennium of miracles in a matter of days. And yet when God called Moses to a summit meeting, the people panicked like henless chicks. They rallied around Aaron and said, "Do something, make gods for us who will lead us. That Moses, the man who got us out of Egypt, who knows what's happened to him?" Exodus 32:1. A scurvy of fear infected the camp. They crafted a metal cow, talked to it, praised it. When God saw the golden calf stunt, he was ready to wipe out the entire nation of Israel. They were eyewitnesses to 10 plagues, one Red Sea opening. Their bellies were full of God-given manna and quail, heaven sent. But did they remember their deliverer? No. They danced the night away in front of a homemade statue. God was not happy. Exodus 32:7-10. "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Go down from this mountain, because your people, the people that you brought out of the land of Egypt, have ruined themselves. They have quickly turned away from the things I commanded them to do. I have seen these people, and I know that they are very stubborn. So now do not stop me. I am so angry with them that I'm going to destroy them. Then I will make you and your descendants a great nation.'" Well, Max writes, "Dry grass on Mount Vesuvius stood a better chance of survival. Their only hope was their octogenarian leader, who met God possibly on this same mountain some years earlier. And if Moses had any clout, this was the time to use it. And so he did. Verses 11 and 12. Moses begged the Lord his God and said, Lord, don't let your anger destroy your people, whom you brought out of Egypt with your great power and strength. Don't let the people of Egypt say the Lord brought the Israelites out of Egypt for an evil purpose. He planned to kill them in the mountains and to destroy them from the earth. So stop being angry and please don't destroy your people. Just look at the passion of Moses there on Mount Sinai. He's not calm and quiet with his hands folded and a serene expression. He's on his face one minute, in God's face the next. He's on his knees, pointing his fingers, lifting his hands and shedding tears and shredding his cloak, wrestling like Jacob at Jabbok for the lives of his people. And how does God react? Verse 14, so the Lord changed his mind and did not destroy as he said he might. And that's a promise of prayer. We can change God's mind. His ultimate will is inflexible, but the implementation of his will is not. He does not ever change in character or purpose, but he does alter his strategy because of the appeals of his children. So we actually, while we do not change his intention, we can influence his actions. It's little wonder that as Moses led the people, he needed a reminder of God's presence from time to time. Exodus 33, 12. Look, he said at one point, you tell me, lead this people, but you don't let me know who you are going to send with me. Verse 16, are you traveling with us or not? You can hardly fault his fears. Encircled first by Israelites who long for Egypt, and a second by a desert of hot winds and blazing boulders. The ex-shepherd needs assistance, and his maker offers it, verse 14 and 17. I myself will go with you. I will do what you ask, because I know you very well, and I am pleased with you. You'd think that would have been enough for Moses, but he lingers, thinking perhaps of that last sentence, I will do what you ask. Perhaps God will indulge one more request. So he swallows and sighs and asks. Well, there's so many requests he could have made. There's like a million people in his rearview mirror. A million stiff-necked, unappreciative ex-slaves who were grumbling about every step. And had Moses prayed, can you turn these people into sheep? God would have probably listened. Who would have blamed him? And what about Israel's enemies? Battlefields lie ahead, combat with the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Termites and the Cellulites, and they infest the land. Can Moses mold an army out of pyramid-building Hebrews? I will do what you ask. God had been ready to be done with the people and start over with Moses as he had with Noah. But Moses pleaded for mercy, and God extended mercy. God, touched by Moses' heart, had heard Moses' prayer and answered it. But Moses needs more. Just one more request. Glory. Verse 18, now please show me your glory. We cross a line when we make such a request. When our deepest desire is not the things of God or the favor of God, but God himself, we cross a threshold. Less self-focus, more God-focus. Less about me, more about him. Show me your radiance, Moses is praying. Flex your biceps. Let me see your preeminence, your heart-stopping, ground-shaking, extra spectacularness. Forget the money and the power. Bypass the youth. I can live with an aging body, but I can't live without you. I want more God. I want to see your glory. Why did Moses want to see God's greatness? Well, you can ask yourself a similar question. Why do you stare at the sunset and ponder the starry night sky? Why do you search for the rainbow in the midst or gaze at the Grand Canyon? Why do you allow the Pacific surf to mesmerize and Victoria Falls to hypnotize? How do we explain our fascination with such sights? Beauty. Yes, but doesn't the beauty point to a beautiful someone? Doesn't the immensity of the ocean suggest an immense creator? Doesn't the rhythm of migrating cranes and beluga whales hint of a brilliant mind? And isn't that what we desire? A beautiful maker, an immense creator, a God so mighty that he can commission the birds and command the fish. Show me your glory, God. That's what Moses begs. Forget a bank. He wants to see Fort Knox. He needs to walk in the vault of God's wealth. Would you stun me with your strength? Numb me with your wisdom? Steal my breath with a brush of yours, a moment in the spray of the cataract of grace, a glimpse of your glory, God. That's the prayer of Moses. And God answers it. He places his servant in the cleft of a rock, telling Moses in Exodus 33:20, "You cannot see my face, for no man shall see me and live. I will cover you with my hand while I pass by, and then I will take away my hand, and you shall see my back, but my face shall not be seen." And so Moses, cowering beneath an umbrella of God's palm, waits. Surely with his eyes closed and face bowed and pulse racing, until God gives a signal. And when the hand lifts, Moses' eyes do the same and catch a distant, disappearing glance of the back parts of God. The heart and center of the Maker is too much for Moses to bear, so a fading glimpse will do. Max continues, "I can see the long gray hair of Moses, wind-whipped forward in his leathery hand, grabbing a rock on the wall lest he fall. And as the gust settles and his locks rest again on his shoulders, we see the impact, his face gleaming, bright as if backlit by a thousand torches. Unknown to Moses, but undeniable to the Israelites, is his shimmering face. And when he descended the mountain, the children of Israel could not look steadily at the face of Moses because of the glory of his countenance." 2 Corinthians 3:7. Witnesses saw not anger in his jaw or worry in his eyes or a scowl on his lips. They saw God's glory in his face. Did he have a reason for worry? A cause for anger? Of course. Challenges await him. A desert and 40 years of great challenges. But now, having seen God's face, he can face them. Forgive me, but shouldn't Moses' request be ours? We've got problems. Just look at us. We're living in a decaying and dying body. We're walking in a decaying world, surrounded by self-centered society, some saved by grace, others fueled by narcissism, some by both. COVID, cancer, war, disease. They're no small issues, but a small God? No thanks. You and I need what Moses needed, a glimpse of God's glory in such a sighting can change you forever. In summary, as a young man, Moses excelled in the ways of the court. He mastered the laws of the ancient land. He studied at the feet of the world's finest astronauts, mathematicians, and lawyers. 1,500 years later, he was remembered, Acts 7:23, learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and mighty in words and deeds. What little we know of Moses' upbringing tells us that he displayed an affinity for higher learning and an allergy to injustice. As you know, he saw an Egyptian and killed him. And when the next day he saw two Hebrews fighting, he intervened again. And this time one of the Hebrews said, "And who made you a prince and a judge over us?" A prince and a judge. How accurate is the description? Turn to the second act. To avoid arrest, Moses, as you know, scampered into the Badlands, and there he even encountered more injustice. Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water, and they filled the troughs to water their father's flock, and then the shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. What drove Moses to protect these young women? Their beauty? His thirst? Maybe both, maybe more. Maybe just his irrepressible seeds of fairness. And when he decked a cruel Egyptian or scattered chauvinistic shepherds, he was acting in his God-given bent toward justice, and the rest of his life would say so. 40 years after he fled Egypt, Moses returned, this time with God's burning bush blessing power. He dismantled Pharaoh, unshackled the Hebrews, and Moses the prince escorted his people into a new kingdom. And Moses the judge framed the Torah and midwifed the Hebrew law. The strengths of his youth unveiled the passions of his life, and God began doing a good work in him. And the same is true of you. Paul writes in Philippians 1:6, God began doing a good work in you, and I am sure he will continue it until it is finished when Jesus Christ comes again. Do you see what God is doing? A good work in you. Do you see when he'll be finished? When Jesus comes again. May I spell out the message for you? God ain't finished with you yet. Your Father wants you to know that. And to convince you, he may surprise you. He may speak from a bush, his holy word. And stranger still, he may even speak to you from this message. Yes, I am certain that God, who began a good work in you, will continue his work until it is finally finished on the day when Jesus Christ returns. Selah.